Hello, it's Tuesday, 14th of September, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Are we offering the annual flu jab at the wrong time? A new study suggests we might be. Also, we're talking about 97% of parents in Britain who think childcare is too expensive. I wonder who the 3% are who don't. Job vacancies booming in Britain, rising above 1 million in 3 months to August, for the first time since records began in 2001. And there was us thinking it was going to be a jobs bloodbath when we came out of COVID. But first, the jab. All children aged 12 to 15 will be offered a COVID jab. But should a 12-year-old be able to overrule a parent as to whether they have it or not? So all children aged 12 to 15 are going to be offered a COVID jab from as early as next week in a drive to protect their health and education. People aged over 50 and vulnerable groups will also receive a third booster jab as part of Boris Johnson's winter plan to avoid further lockdowns. I'm joined now by Dr. Lawrence Young, who's a virologist and professor of molecular oncology at Warwick. Dr. Young, can I ask you just first of all, have the government made this unnecessarily complicated by saying 12-year-olds, if their parents are in disagreement, can be the final arbiter as to whether they have the jab? Is it really for a 12-year-old to decide rather than mum and dad?
The whole thing has been really complicated, hasn't it? And it's all been really made much worse by all the dithering that's gone on. There is a full vaccination programme. I mean, other vaccines are given out to school children, and particularly to children of that age. And there is this issue about the competence of the child to make a decision. But I think at the end of the day, it has to be a joined up decision with parents. And I'm confident that many parents and many children will just recognise the benefits of getting vaccinated.
The jab as well, I don't want to be pouring cold water on everything here, but would it have been more sensible, because we know children don't get particularly sick from COVID, but they are spreaders, and so therefore wouldn't it have been advantageous to have got a lot of these jabs into children's arms before they went back to school?
Yes, and you know, there's been dithering. It's been more than 3 months since the MHRA approved vaccination for this age group. Other countries have gone on and vaccinated, in fact, more than 12 million 12 to 17 year olds have been vaccinated in the US. But you know, JCVI took a very cautious approach. You could say they were looking at that narrow issue of the medical benefit and making sure that the benefits outweigh the risks. And they came to this marginal decision that it was probably too close to call, and have left it to the chief medical officers to make that decision. Yeah.
But and the chief medical officers took a more broad decision because they took into account the impact on children's lives if school is disrupted again, if they're sent home again, potential impact on their mental health. So it was, in a sense, a more rounded decision than the one the JCVI made.
Yes, well, I did think it was interesting, Andrew. Yesterday, the chair of the JCVI was waxing lyrical about the impact of school closures on health and well-being. And I think, well, why didn't you discuss that at the JCVI?
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is, it is an issue here. We do know, you know, children do get sick. You know, over July, 1,000 under 18-year-olds in England were admitted to hospital with COVID. So we know it's a small number, but it's a significant number. But the biggest benefit, of course, is to protect the well-being by ensuring there are no further disruptions to children's education.
How traumatic, how bad an impact do you think the effect of these school closures, not taking their exams, which, I mean, I can remember I'd have been heartbroken if I couldn't have done my exams. I worked so hard for them. What impact do you think it's likely to have long term on children? I know kids are robust, but is there going to be lasting damage?
I think there may well be. It's not just the issue of education itself. Of course, it's all the social interactions that children have missed. And, you know, that I think that's a really big issue that we need to address. And, you know, we just got to support these youngsters, because it has been, you know, as tough for them, if not tougher than for the rest of us. And I think, you know, we hear a lot about physical health, but all of us have suffered mentally from being locked down, and the children disproportionately so. I remember one of the things that really is important here is those children, particularly in deprived areas of the country, where they might not have, for a variety of reasons, the same parental support. I think that's it's been really tough for those children.
And just finally, Dr. Young, the booster jabs for over 50s, some scientists argue they're not necessary. Some scientists argue they are necessary. We know the World Health Organization would have preferred Britain to use those jabs to send to countries where vaccination rollout has not been very, it's not been taken up very, very widely. What's your view on boosters?
I think boosters are really important, particularly for the elderly and vulnerable who were vaccinated at the very beginning of the vaccine rollout and whose immune systems aren't as robust as younger folk. And I think we've already seen some data, not only from this country, but other countries, including Israel, where the immune response is waning. And in fact, Israel, who started boosting their over 60s about a month ago, are already seeing the benefit of that and have seen a sharp fall in the number of over 60s being hospitalized. So I have to say, I'm really in favor of boosters. And I actually think this argument about impacting the global supply of vaccines is it's a drop in the ocean. We're talking about, you know, tens of millions of vaccines up against the need for billions. I think we need to support the global rollout, but I can't see that vaccinating our own population should impact negatively on our ability to support global vaccination.
Indeed. Okay, that's very interesting. That's Dr. Lawrence Young, virologist and professor at Warwick Medical School. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and much more. If you want to get in touch, you tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Job vacancies are booming in Britain, rising above 1 million in the 3 months to August for the first time since records began in 2001. Figures also showed employee numbers were back at pre-COVID levels in August. This is according to the Office for National Statistics. But some business groups are now warning that labour shortages could dampen growth. I'm joined now by Miatta van Buller, who's chief executive of the New Economics Foundation. Miatta, people are always going to complain, aren't they? There were apocalyptic warnings when COVID gripped the country, first of all, that unemployment could soar as high as 9% of the working population, record unemployment figures, and actually nothing like that's happened. And now business leaders are complaining we may not have enough workers.
Well, so I think the jobs growth story is a really positive one. No one could predict how we would come out of the pandemic. And I think the recovery in that area has probably been better than anyone predicted or expected. But I do think business leaders are right to be cautious and to be worried, because what we're seeing is that we're not quite out of the woods yet. And I think there's a combination of labour market shortages as a consequence of Brexit, plus the pandemic, meaning that actually we probably have workers in sectors that are declining, but they don't have the skill sets for the jobs that have been created in other sectors. I think that creates a real problem in the medium term.
Just go through this if we can. Why are job vacancies so strong? Why are there so many in your view, Miatta, especially when we compare it with the warnings we'd had when the Chancellor introduced the furlough scheme about how bleak this could be when we start emerging from COVID?
Well, so I think part of it is, if you look at some of the sectors where we've got the biggest vacancies, health and social care, actually that predated the pandemic. We have had a problem recruiting people into that sector because they're not paid very well. They're asked to do really, really tough work that's not valued enough. And that's a massive problem for us in the backdrop of everything we've been talking about social care. I think if we take another area like hospitality, it's a combination of the fact that I think there are people who are still wary about going into hospitality because we're not out of the pandemic yet. And people don't necessarily want to be doing front-facing roles where you have to be, exposed to lots of people. And so some will be on furlough, some will be holding back. So I think there are a set of issues that are coming into play. And I don't think we can underestimate Brexit in here. So if you think about, the composition of the workforce in the hospitality sector, there was a mixture of EU workers as well as domestic workers. And I think that's all coming into play. So I think there were some pandemic factors, there were some long-standing factors, but it's all coming together. And I can't emphasize the need for us to try to manage this, because there's a world in which we do the smart and we think, gosh, we've got a whole lot of people on furlough. How do we skill them up to create the opportunities for them to take up some of the jobs that are being created? And how do we do it in a way that allows them to transition smoothly? And the key question for the next year is that is how smooth we can make that transition. Or do we pull off all support and say, get on with it, hopefully the market will sort it all out, and then in a year and a half's time, we find that that hasn't happened, and actually the economy is really struggling as a consequence.
Now, you've mentioned Brexit two or three times. One of the consequences of Brexit, of course, some people from Eastern Europe have gone back home. I think some of those might have gone back home anyway when COVID gripped Britain, as it did throughout Europe. But isn't this now a time when employers have to start paying better wages? We know one of the reasons there's a shortage of HGV drivers, Miatta, is because their pay has been going down proportionately over the last decade. It's why a lot of them, the drivers, are retiring. And we also know during COVID, 40-odd thousand drivers who might have been trained up weren't able to do that. We've heard of farmers complaining that they haven't got, effectively what they're complaining about is cheap European labour to go into the field. Well, start paying them some more proper wages. Wouldn't that be make a big difference?
100%. So I'm not going to disagree with you on that. I think that actually the fact that people are, you know, some people will be choosing to stay away from these jobs because they're, you know, low paid, and why would you do it? I think we'll force employers to think about conditions, to think about standards, to think about pay, and that is absolutely a good thing. But I come back to the fact that, you know, and I think that will happen because if you're desperately looking for people to fill roles, you will start thinking about how do we make the roles more attractive. But on the flip side, we've got to create the pipeline of people to take up these roles, and that requires us to think about what are the skills that we need for the jobs that are becoming vacant, good news, and therefore, how do we make sure that the workforce that we do have are well skilled to do those roles?
And what of furlough, just finally, Miatta? We're still there's still a lot of people in furlough. They come out of furlough by the end of this month. In your view, has furlough perhaps gone on for too long?
No, so we've got 1 million people on furlough, and you know, they are predominantly in sectors like hospitality, in sectors like arts and culture, where, you know, if we're honest, the fallout from the pandemic is still really hitting those sectors. You know, there are still restrictions around, you know, the number of people you can have. Everyone's still finding their feet. So I think there's still quite a lot of instability and uncertainty. You know, at some point, the current scheme that we have, I think, will be wound down. But the thing I would say is, you look over to what our partners, you know, and other countries in Europe are doing. You know, Germany have a permanent support scheme because they say, well, we're going to have industries that are really struggling. And we know that happens anyway outside of a pandemic. It happened after the financial crisis. Why not create a mechanism whereby when these industries are struggling, well, we know people are going to have to transition out of those, we provide part-time work that's subsidized and training so that we can get people from sectors that are struggling and likely to decline smoothly into sectors that have been created rather than just leaving a free-for-all and hoping it all works out. And so, you know, while furlough in its current guise, I imagine, will be wound down, I desperately hope the government learns some lessons from, you know, countries like Germany who are taking a different tact and think about, well, what's the permanent thing that we need that means that sectors like aviation, really struggling still, going to struggle as we start moving towards responding to climate change. What on earth are we doing to transition those workers out in a way that feels just?
Very interesting. That's Miatta van Bulle. She's Chief Executive of the New Economics Foundation. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. 97% of parents in Britain think that childcare is too expensive. That's according to a survey of more than 20,000 working parents conducted by one dozen charities. Ministers say, however, they're not going to review these costs despite the survey's finding. I'm joined now by Victoria Benson, who's Chief Executive of Gingerbread and is a single parent herself. Victoria, I'm very tempted to ask the first question. 97% think it's too expensive. Who are the 3% who don't?
Well, I can only think that it's very wealthy people who are happy paying the very high amounts that childcare providers charge for their services.
Would you say there is an average cost for a parent for a child, or does it depend on which part of the country you're in?
Well, it depends which part of the country you're in, and it depends how old your child is. So the younger your child, a baby's, for example, it's much more expensive to use a nursery or a nanny.
Yeah, and if you're a single parent, it must be really difficult.
Well, it's really tough for single parents because they're more likely to be in lower paid jobs. And so they have less disposable income to spend on childcare. But of course, because they can't juggle with another parent, they're more reliant on childcare. So it's absolutely essential for single parents that there is affordable, flexible childcare available for them.
And of course, this wretched pandemic, Victoria, has reared its ugly head in childcare. The Labour MP for Walthamstow, Stella Creasy, quoted Ofsted figures showing more than 400 nurseries have closed during the pandemic, which must be causing huge pressure.
Yes, it's caused a lot of pressure. And we've also expecting more childcare providers to close as the furlough scheme ends and, you know, to coincide with people returning back to offices. And we're expecting both childcare providers and childminders not, you know, to have to stop working. So the pressure on working parents and single parents is just going to increase.
And I'm just looking here, a full-time place in a nursery can cost £12,376 on average. We've got the third most expensive childcare system in the world behind Slovakia and Switzerland. That's according to the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. And when you think of Switzerland, you think of tax exiles and wealthy people.
Yes. Yes, I mean it's crazy that I think actually it's right that we do need to pay childcare providers a living wage, and I have no issue with that at all, because of course we need to pay a good wage in order to get good quality care. So that isn't the issue; it's the cost of childcare to the working parent that's the issue. And if the government was able to subsidise the sector and review it, then that would help all working parents, but, you know, single parents particularly.
Yeah, and I see there was a petition signed by over 112,000 parents after that debate in Parliament, because some people are saying it's financially crippling, or they're just having to give up their careers and so they stay home and look after the children. What would you, because some people listening to this, Victoria, might say, well, perhaps that's what a parent should do, stay at home and look after their children. That's what was done in my day.
Yes, well, firstly, I think for many single parents, that isn't an option. They need to go to work in order to feed and clothe their children. The welfare system in this country penalises parents who don't go to work, so they don't have any choice. But for many single parents, and for many parents, many of whom, of course, are women, they don't want to have to give up their career when they have children. They want to carry on working, and they want to progress, and they want to do that at the same time as having a family.
Yeah, and of course, it's often a dilemma that isn't faced by the dad.
No. I mean, more than 90% of single parents are women. So if you're looking at the population of single parents, it's predominantly women that are facing this issue. But of course, in many couple parents as well, it's definitely a gendered issue, and it's the woman that is faced with the choice, give up work or pay for childcare. And that's a whole different issue, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely fascinating. Thank you for that. That's Victoria Benson, who is the chief executive of Gingerbread. So that time in the podcast, time to talk Matters Square Mile. Who better to talk about that than Hugo Duncan, who is, of course, the Daily Mail's deputy city editor. So tell me all about chip designer Arm. Japanese owners want to flog it off to the Americans. What's all that about?
Well, that's right, Andrew. Arm Holdings, which listeners may or may not have heard of anyway, it was set up 30 years ago in Cambridge, or Silicon Fen, which is where it's still based. It designs chips that are used in smartphones, laptops, tablet computers, smart TVs, you name it. Mm. It's probably got an Arm-designed chip in it. And it was a great, great British success story. It was on the FTSE 100,
yeah.
A favourite among investors. But in 2016, it was bought by the Japanese, by SoftBank, for nearly £25
billion.
Of course, that meant it was removed from the London Stock Exchange. And it has been owned by SoftBank ever since. But fast forward to today, and SoftBank are now trying to sell it to the Americans, to a US rival called Nvidia, for almost £30 billion. This has caused a bit of a stink. And regulators here in the UK and in Europe are worried that the combination of these two companies are going to stifle competition, make matters more difficult for customers, and in the end, people like you and I who might be buying our smartphones or laptops, etc. So the deal is now in doubt because of these regulatory problems. A new solution is emerging. Now, at the moment, this is a solution that people would like to see happening. People from outside would like to see happening. You know, there have been various supports of this idea, but it would be, instead of SoftBank selling Arm to the Americans, it would be refloating it on the stock market in London.
Right.
Now, that would bring a great British tech company back to the UK from Japanese ownership rather than letting it be bought by the Americans. It would put it on the stock market. Shareholders, pension funds, anyone who wanted to could buy shares in this company. It would be a very, very large float as well, coming into the UK market at around £30 billion. It would be one of the biggest we have seen in many a year. It would be an enormous boost for the city, and something that I've no doubt the Chancellor, who is who's trying to bolster the city's credentials in the wake of Brexit and the pandemic, would also welcome. But at the moment, this is a hope among various people rather than the plan on the table, which is still to sell it to the Americans.
I get all that, but what I don't understand is, Hugo, how it technically operates then. Because if this company has been bought by a Japanese firm, why do they care what Britain thinks about whether they sell it to America?
Well, because it operates here, and it operates, indeed, it operates all around the world. Its customers are all around the world. Regulators across the world will look at this.
Right.
Now, if regulators decide that it would be no good for competition around the world for this deal to go ahead, and SoftBank still wants to offload Arm, the question is,
how do they do it?
Do they hang on to it? Do they sell it to someone else? Or
why don't they sell it back to the public markets? Why don't they float it on the Japanese market?
I think the preference for many people involved, if it were to be floated, would be in London. It is a Cambridge-based company. It's a British company. I think that would make more sense. I think it would also possibly attract a higher price. I mean, maybe they may feel they'd get an even higher price in New York. That would be something that would be considered if they did go down this route. But I think should there be a suggestion that it would be floated, I think the political pressure would be enormous for it to happen here, because as I say, this is a great British success story that's been in foreign ownership for 5 years and could indeed come back.
Look, we're free marketeers and we believe in the market, but sometimes it's absolutely infuriating, isn't it, to hear some of these great British companies that end up in foreign hands.
Well, indeed, and I mean, you can be a free marketeer and believe that, and indeed you can also believe that the best place for it would be back on the public markets in the UK, where our pension funds and our ISAs and so on would benefit from any future growth in that company.
Rishi Sunak, he'll be whispering in their ears, won't he?
I would be amazed if there aren't conversations happening behind the scenes. At the moment, it is still in the hands of regulators, really, and indeed politicians. There's quite a long way to go. Our SoftBank is having its own difficulties with Arm in the East and in China. So, you know, this one has a long way to rumble, but a solution that many people would like to see and is increasingly being spoken about as a possibility, should this deal not get over the line, is to bring this company back to the market in London.
Great story, and we'll keep watching it and waiting. That's Hugo Duncan, who's Deputy City Editor of the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. Are we offering people the annual flu jab at the wrong time? A new study is to investigate whether the vaccine would be more effective when given in November, some 2 months after the typical September start to the vaccination programme, after suggestions its effectiveness wanes over time. I'm joined by the health writer, Fiona McRae. Fiona, I've only ever had one flu jab, and that was last September. And I've just noticed I've had a note from my GP saying, are you going to have another one this September? So should I delay it till November?
Well, I guess that's what this study is trying to find out. But the advice at the moment is, when you're offered your jab, have it. Even the researchers doing the latest study say, don't wait for now, we don't know. So if you get offered your jab, just have it when you know, as soon as you can.
Why are they doing this study then? Where is the suggestion come from that perhaps the effectiveness wanes over time?
Yes, so that's quite interesting. So there's been several recent studies in America where they've tried to compare the number of cases in flu over time and the people who have been vaccinated and the people who haven't. And it seems if you have your jab, protection is strongest so about 2-3 weeks after you're vaccinated. And then as each month goes on, it tails off. So it suggests, you know, that your immunity is waning, basically.
But why could November be potentially more effective than September? Is that because you should have it in the winter months?
Yeah, so flu is kind of a maverick virus that does what it wants, but generally the flu season is worst in January, February. If you were vaccinated in November, your protection should still be high in theory come January, February. Whereas if you have your jab in September, come February, your immunity might be pretty low. That's the thinking anyway.
It's intriguing. Why? Because, I mean, the flu jab's been around since the year dot. Interesting that they're doing this study now. Why perhaps they hadn't thought of doing it before?
I asked several people why we have this September start, and the answer seemed to be, you know, it's something that's traditionally always been done. Making the vaccines is a lengthy process, you know, it takes about 6 months.
Yeah.
So there'd be a lot to change if the vaccine program does change.
And this is a study being done in Leicester, and I note these figures too, that flu claims around 17,000 lives a year in England on average. How effective is the flu jab seen, Fiona, in keeping those numbers down?
It's seen as pretty vital. I mean, the effectiveness of a jab varies from year to year, but it's seen as pretty vital in those at most of risk of complications, you know, particularly the elderly. It's something that we should have if we're offered it, basically.
Yeah, and do you suspect the booster jab that's going to come out to oldies like me for COVID, that they might try to link that with the flu jab?
It would make sense in one way logistically, but in the other way, you've got to try and combine the two programs, which, if I know anything about the NHS, the way all the data is stored in numerous different computer systems, it might be a little bit tricky.
All right. And just finally on this, Fiona, this study, it's a study of 400 healthcare workers they're doing. How bit comprehensive is a study of 400 workers? I mean, could we really see the flu jab recommended date change from September to November based on a study of 400 people?
No, I think so that they're planning to repeat the study and sort of extend it this coming winter. And then I guess any recommendations will look at the broader picture. So look at the American research, for instance, and they may also... any change in recommendations may also require other particular studies to be conducted. But this is certainly a very good starting point. And unlike the American studies just sort of analysed data that was already there. So they sort of looked at figures from a few years back and tried to find a pattern. Whereas the folk in Leicester are vaccinating people and then tracking them, which in theory should give a more reliable result.
I see. Yeah. Just finally, Fiona, what month are you having your jab?
Well, like you, I've only ever had one, but I'm about to squeak, I think, into the oldies category, as you call it.
So, right. Yeah, yeah.
So we'll see.
Maybe around the same time.
The text or the phone call, yeah.
Absolutely. All right. That's the health writer, Fiona McRae, talking about when it is or isn't a good time to have the flu jab. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.